listening to CFRO 102.7 FM. Welcome to Animal Voices. This show is brought to you through the cooperative efforts of three local groups, Vancouver Humane Society, Earth Save Canada, and Animal Defense and Anti-Vivisection Society. Views expressed are not necessarily those of these societies. My name is Marge Adams. In the studio with me are Alan Jensen, our technician, Carl Loskin and John Pranger, our co-hosts, and we are very pleased today to have two special guests in the studio, Marvin Moot and Paul Springate of the Rainforest Reptile Refuge Society. We'll be speaking with them very shortly. Later in the show, we'll have an interview with Patricia Oswald, who is president of Citizens for the Ethical Treatment of Farm Animals, CETFA. Yes. Canadians for the Ethical Treatment of Farm Animals, I'm sorry about that, or CETFA. Now I'd like to get to our studio guests so we don't waste any time. Marvin Moot is the president of the Rainforest Reptile Refuge Society, and Paul Springate is the curator of the Society's Animal Shelter in Surrey. Welcome to you both.
Hi, Marge.
It's great to have you here. Now, we'll have to assume our audience doesn't know anything about the society. So maybe, Marvin, you wouldn't mind giving us a little background information, a little bit of history, and maybe tell us the mission of the society.
Well, Marge, the society started out as an animal shelter by a couple who were concerned about the numbers of abandoned and neglected reptiles in the community. And they quickly filled their apartment and moved to our present location. We're in Surrey, and but even our present facilities filled up rather quickly, and we realized that we cannot shelter all the animals in that are out there. So we now our big focus is education, and we do a lot of school tours. We do provide a home for over 300 reptiles. And those animals are part of our educational programming.
Wow, that's really impressive. 300 is a lot of reptiles.
Yeah, well, we could have thousands, I'd say. Hey, Paul?
Absolutely.
And that it's a constant demand, I'm sure, to bring more in. And so we'll talk a little bit about that. But first of all, maybe Paul, since he's the curator and probably works a lot right in the shelter, could tell us, give us a little description of what the shelter is.
Well, basically, we try to hone a little bit on the animal instincts. We don't just throw them in boxes and say, okay, well, here they are, come take a look at them. Our aim is to be able to show people that there's a little bit more involved than just, you know, feeding and cleaning up after them. You have to try and use a bit of anything you can find to recreate their natural habitat. Snakes that climb, you want them in a cage with trees. Crocodilians, I mean, you want them somewhere where they can spend a lot of time in the water as well as basking under a sun lamp. It's hard, you know. You see tens of thousands of animals out there, and only a few of the lucky ones get to become part of what I call the family. And it is a lot of work. I mean, it's day in, day out, 7 days a week. You're making sure that animals' needs are taken care of.
Do you have a large staff?
No. It's one of the things that comes with volunteering. It's very hard to find dedicated individuals that really want to spend the time. I think that in today's economy, people need to be making money and not volunteering all the time. But I can't believe for one second that there's not people out there undying to be able to help wildlife. Even though here in Vancouver we call them exotics, they're just wildlife from somewhere else.
Yes, and you have a lot of really dedicated volunteers, I understand.
The refuge is pretty much 100% volunteer run. I mean, Paul gets some living expenses, but the whole thing is run by volunteers, and it's an incredible opportunity to work with animals that you would not have the opportunity to spend time with. So it's a real privilege, yeah.
It's not a student group at the university, perhaps, who would like some field work experience?
We do have individuals who are working on projects and students from high schools, all sorts of different kind of people become involved, yes.
I see. And are you open to the public?
on the weekends.
I see.
Actually,
I see.
We do a lot of educational tours during the week for all sorts of school groups, private groups, you name it. And we go like Tuesday through Friday where we bring people in. We give them an hour where we really concentrate on all the problems. We take them around and give as much as we can in that hour and let people see the animals, talk a bit about them. They learn about the problem. A lot of people walk in expecting like a typical zoo to just look at animals. I think that people really walk out of there with a lot more than they thought they were going to get when they walked in.
It's truly a shelter for animals, isn't it? It's not an entertainment center. It's
no.
An education center if it's
absolutely, 100%. I mean, that's what we are. It's education and awareness. I don't know how great a benefit it is to the animals to be stared at by people every day, but that's the only way we're going to teach people. You have literally thousands of kids that go to a pet store and want the corn snake in the window or the python or not knowing anything about it, and they buy them as a novelty. And so what we're trying to do is battle that at a lower age level, at the children, to teach them that these are wild animals. Keeping snakes in Rubbermaid containers is of no benefit to the snake. It's nothing more than just a shallow existence for the animal. Whereas the animals that we have, I mean, I call it a sanctuary. We call it a sanctuary where they're left alone. We don't typically pull them out and handle them and show them off and take them around.
Are they all reptiles that you have?
Pretty much. We also have a couple amphibians, but typically, I would say probably a good 85% are reptiles.
The first animal that you see when you come in is a sulcata tortoise, which someone probably bought, and it was the size of
Spud.
A small plate.
Or a potato.
this animal really should be roaming across the plains of Africa, and it will grow to, it'll live for up to 100 years.
Third largest species in the world of tortoise. Largest from Africa.
And it'll in diameter, its shell will measure over a meter once it becomes full grown. It's what, 7 years right now?
It's really sad because you take an animal like Spud, he's in a cage. Whereas this animal roams the deserts, like you said, Marvin, is vast, arid regions. But yet, as much as we can give him, I mean, we still have him in a cage. We're actually presently building this guy a pretty darn large tortoise cage. One of the big issues with this tortoise is that you're supposed to keep them outdoors. Well, then why are they in Canada? You can't keep a tortoise outdoors here in these months. Mm-hmm. And therefore, it tends to work against the animal system. He's a young, growing male and needs to roam. So oftentimes, he has the run of the refuge when nobody else is around. It's myself running around in snake cages and Spud running around looking at all the other animals.
What would his temperature, what should his temperature be?
Oh, in the mid-80s.
Mid-80s?
Yeah. Pretty much the equator of Africa. You've got to keep it very warm. Oftentimes, one of the big problems with health risks with these animals, I mean, for the animals themselves, people have them in their home and they have a spot lamp on them. Well, that's not really what we call atmospheric temperature. It makes a big difference. Our refuge is, I mean, our heat is cranked all the time.
We get up to 30 degrees by mid-afternoon. We're at about 30 degrees at least because right. The animals, they cannot metabolize their food unless they're kept that warm.
But as hard as you try, you cannot make it a natural setting for those creatures, can you?
I think we could reach something like that, but that we're talking millions of dollars. We're talking like a real massive establishment, something that, I mean, you see a lot of zoos put tens of thousands of dollars. One of the realistic sides is being a society. We need the support of the community. We do have an incredible backbone supporter group like our donors. I mean, I'd love to actually take a moment just to thank them. I mean, I can wrestle snakes and deal with crocodiles until I'm blue in the face, but without the donor support, we wouldn't be going anywhere. But it's hard to expand. That's what we're always looking at is to move forward and grow. And the main focus of that is for the animals. The public's demand, I mean, the public's expectations are, I mean, I'm blown away on a regular basis, daily, by the amount of animals that are called in. It's something that I would really love to share with the public is to know that being in a refuge where you are dealing with these animals, you've got a few hundred of them and you're running around like a madman looking after them all day, but the phone calls never stop. I would have thought a few years ago that maybe, you know, you'd get the phone call here and there and maybe, you know, once a week. No, it's more like 2-3 times a day. And most of our phone calls are probably asking us to take reptiles. People like to say, can they donate their iguana? whereas we don't really look at them as a donation. People, this is a responsibility.
People call us up and they almost think that we're some kind of government agency, and they have a lot of expectations, and they're really, we get over 2, maybe 3,000 calls a year for people wanting to give us their animal or donate their animal, and this is an animal that's sort of been circulated between family members and friends, and maybe the landlord's got it now or something like that.
You don't get any cooperation, I mean financial cooperation, from governments, huh? Or do you?
Our support comes from individual donors. We have no government support. We don't have contracts like the SPCA.
But we are actually often called in to be able to deal with these animals. Yeah, SPCA holds an animal control contract. However, they don't have any facilities to accommodate reptiles. And oftentimes when dealing take a moment to say dangerous reptiles. I mean, they're not the majority. The majority are the small ones that people think, oh, it's not a big deal if it's a little snake. Well, that snake's from Africa and it shouldn't be here, I think, is a big deal.
Paul was recently called in by the RCMP into East Vancouver. You may want to talk about that, Paul.
Yeah, bit of an emotional thing for me. In the middle of the night, I was given a call and was police escorted downtown to East Vancouver to wrestle a 7-foot crocodilian out of a crack house. Well, when I got there, there's this poor little animal. Well, what was funny is all the police and everybody wants to hear about the crocodile hunter type stories. Oh, wow, it's great. I walk into this house and I'm told not to touch anything, and they open the door and this 6.5-foot tall, heavy weighted police officer jumped out of his skin. I look down and I see this poor little baby. This is like a maybe 3 or 4 year old animal, maybe 5 years, about 4 feet long, a caiman, which is a type of crocodilian, much like an alligator or crocodile, but they're from South America. And it was scared to death. It ran and went straight into the wall. Had no food, very little water in the tank, nothing in the... I mean, it's on a hardwood floor. This is not where crocodilians live. They live in mud where they feel it between their toes. They slide into water. They swim. They catch fish. They contribute to the ecosystems. When I was told to grab this croc, I had to wait for them to say, okay, is it a goat, you know? Are you going to do it? Do you need help? And I said, you know what? This animal looks like it's dying. Its backbone was showing. And that was something that really hit hard on me. I've never seen that. This animal is starving to death. You walk into a situation like that and you think, you know, it becomes a media story about, oh, there's a crocodile in a house and, ooh, scary. What I felt was this poor animal has been treated like hell all its life. It doesn't know what's going on. It was scared to death, and it hardly fought back. A croc should be turning around trying to bite your hands off. I mean, that would be healthy. All this croc did was close its eyes and tense up and just not move. And I picked it up under my arm, carried it out. And one of the most difficult parts of that was that we ended up with the animal. We have a number of crocodilians, and I'll tell you, we really can't keep taking them. These animals get big. They're told they sell them in pet stores is under a foot long. Cute little babies, and they lie to people. One of the biggest lies in the pet trade, I think, that exists was probably about 100 years ago when somebody said, you know what, we can sell anything if we just tell people. It'll only grow as big as its enclosure. I don't think there's an animal on Earth that grows the size of its enclosure. I think that hinders a lot of growth problems and promotes disease. But this animal, we ended up with this croc. And I specifically outlined to the RCMP, I can help you remove it, but we can't take it. You know, we have so many of them, and right now we're presently trying to build our caiman an incredible home, which I hope will be done soon. It's never soon enough. I mean, some of our caimans are exceeding 8 and 9 feet in length. I mean, they're getting big. And these are sold to people as house pets. A crocodilian that weighs 500 pounds that can rip a man's body apart, it's nuts.
We have about, 22?
24. 24 caimans of, we actually have 4 of 6 species of caiman, but of course in the pet trade they're just called spectacled caiman, which is inaccurate. There's only 3 of 6 species that would hold that name due to a bony ridge between the eyes that makes it look like spectacles, or what we call glasses now.
It's not like we're collecting these animals. I mean, we would like nothing more than to send them back to the Amazon, you know, or Central America, wherever they come from, but...
Days ago, we had a foot-long croc brought to our back door. Right after there was actually an ad in the buy and sell for an American alligator in Langley, which I had a little bit of a problem with after a pit bull, an ex-pit bull owner. I guess this fellow really liked dogs, and he really loved his pit bulls. I can understand that. You know, they have a really bad reputation, but I believe strongly that most of the time it's how they're treated. Dogs don't just turn around and rip kids apart for no reason. much like people. I mean, you know, they end up in bad places because of how they're treated or, you know. But this animal came to us. So this is a little baby croc, and we're expected to take it. We got no money with it, but here it is. They can't, that's right, dumped. They can't facilitate it. They said, well, we don't want it to die, so we brought it to you. But, you know, we don't have a football-sized field crocodilian farm.
So what do you do in a case like that? Do you just say no and that's that? Or
you know, Marge, the hardest thing is looking into an animal's eyes, knowing that if you don't take it, it'll probably end up dead.
I can imagine. Yeah.
Our policy is that we are not able to take any more animals. We do have over 300, and we're trying to do a really good job with the animals we have. And we just have limited resources, but animals do show up. We do get calls from Ministry of Children and Families. We get calls from the RCMP and
apartment managers that the snake got left behind and they don't have to do. The SPCA will literally call us up once a week with a snake that was found because whoever, of course, if we don't take it, they just think very clever. What's very interesting is some of the people that have these animals, venomous snakes and crocodilians are found in crack houses. And everybody buying snakes, well, why are they all showing up loose? And I hear stories. I mean, going out and people find out who I am and what I do. They're I used to have a boa constrictor, but it got away.
Yeah.
And I can't believe how many animals are on the loose. I mean, this is a real problem.
Do you find a lot of, or have a lot of abandoned animals brought to you?
Oh, absolutely.
That may be found in parks?
Absolutely, absolutely. And on that note, we actually, this summer, had two corn snakes left in our driveway with a note expecting us to take them, saying, well, we know you'll take good care of them, but they left them in our driveway. Mm-hmm. That's not healthy. And iguanas, one day when I went out for supplies and came back in a couple hours, or I believe it was actually Marvin here that found them, there was a cat cab with two iguanas. Sometimes people think they're doing the good thing by rescuing animals. What I want people to realize about animal rescue is it is a profession. It's not a hobby. You can't go out and you can't just go. I mean, helping wildlife and bringing it to the right people is good. I don't want to take away from that. But you get a lot of people going, oh, but we felt so bad, and they get the animal and then they bring it to me and there's no solution. And it gets to be where the problem is getting worse. You have people who their heart goes out and they bring home all these animals in private shelters on the residential road. But elderly women that don't know anything about crocs and pythons should not be bringing them home, whether they feel bad for them or not. That's why I think it's time that in this country, if we have such a problem with this, that maybe it's time that we evolve something like this refuge center into an educational center, into a government-funded operation. Because
absolutely.
When you've got tortoises that live over 100 years that are all over Vancouver, well, and they keep showing up, well, what are we going to do? Just keep killing them? I don't think that's a solution.
Why did you guys start up? I mean, there's no solution otherwise. I mean, you saw a problem and you created this shelter, and there's no other.
That's right. It's
well,
the only.
You better ask for some money from the government if it's that kind of a job.
You know, if they were listening, yes. Can we have some? You know, I mean, it is really hard. We're expected to take all these animals and do everything and be used by the police and the SPCA.
Amazing.
But yet, they're not paying us. I mean, you know, can I get paid to come and wrestle crocodiles in the middle of the night, please?
And I think we need to also talk about where these animals come from. You know, in the past few years, there's been an increase in the number of reptiles coming into Canada because there's new limits on bringing wild-caught birds in, and so reptiles have become a bit of a mainstay in the pet trade. They're the income earners.
And anybody out there, if you're listening, ask. Or how many of you know people that have an exotic pet, a parrot or a monkey? I mean, even for let's shoot really high. People have lions. People have tigers. People have monkeys. People have all sorts of animals. The pet trade here is getting really bad. What I've recently been saying to people is without legislation passed, we basically have our front doors wide open to the black market, and we're allowing it. We have countries like Australia that says that reptilia is protected. It's very, very strict limiting on the export of any animals out of Australia. Yet we have tens of thousands of bearded dragons showing up in just about every pet store across Canada.
So with legislation, is that part of the answer? I don't think there's the whole answer with all of these that we have already in the country. But
it would definitely be a major first step. I think it's baby steps are what we're doing. We're teaching people, we're teaching children, and sitting here talking to the public right now. But until these guys are not allowed to sell crocodiles and pythons that, you know, I mean, we have the largest snake in the country in our facility. This is a reticulated python. For anybody out there who doesn't know what that is, they're the longest snakes in the world. In Indonesia, they're known as the jungle snake. And if you ask anybody in Indonesia what they're known for, they say, eat people.
They're very aggressive. And it's interesting. I met a woman who works in the pet trade, and she said, yeah, and you know what they're doing now is they have a hybrid out, and they're called mini retics because the retics get so big, you know, it's inconvenient to keep in your home, but now you can buy yourself a smaller version.
They call them dwarfs, but you never know what you're going to get.
But these are by nature very aggressive animals. We're just rolling our eyes on that one.
Which makes me wonder how Paul makes out, because you're the kind of the main key in this refuge, aren't you, as far as the hands-on?
Well, I look at this as a sacrifice on the animal's behalf. They're looked at by people every day, which, of course, I doubt any single one of them wants to be. I think it's really hard on the animals being in captivity. To anywhere in the world, I think that most zoological practice would agree with me. I mean, you're constantly trying to figure out a way to make their lives easier, make it a little more comfortable, because they can't leave. You know, you see tortoises clawing at the door, or pushing down doors, trying to get through. Iguanas scratching their way through the, you know, it is hard. I mean, when it comes to dangerous animals, I think that my love of nature and my innate experience with them, my knowledge, I would say I'm more afraid of them than most people are because I know more about them. Mm. But at the same time, I respect them at an incredibly high level. If an animal is pooping in a cage, I'm not just going to be too afraid to go in there. It needs to be cleaned. If we have that animal, then we've got to do everything we can to keep it in good health. And when I was talking about a sacrifice on the animal's behalf, if they're going to make that sacrifice, I'm going to make the sacrifice too. I'll stand alongside them.
Have you ever had a really challenging situation with an animal as far as endangering yourself?
Yeah, you could say that. Yeah. I mean, you're constantly dodging attacks. And, I mean, these big snakes, people think that, when they're that big and weigh 300 pounds and the size of a basketball and girth, they can't move fast. Need to read a book on snakes. The bigger they are, the faster they move.
See, these animals are wild animals, and that's what we constantly try and tell people, you know, that
you cannot
tame
them.
They are hardwired to act in a certain way, and they're either defending or they're acting aggressively. They're not going to become tame, and we get a lot of people who drop their animal off when they're going to get a baby, say, or after they've been bit, you know, and they just don't understand that it's not a kitten, it's not a puppy.
And most people don't realize that the money that they're spending in these pet stores is going directly to the black market. It's supporting the trade. You buy bearded dragon, well, how are you going to feed it? Of course, you got to go and buy crickets and mealworms and things like that. These bugs from where? The pet shop. And when you go, I mean, there's people that I've met that end up giving us iguanas that really, they went into the pet store to buy goldfish, but they're sold on everything. I mean, not only are you going to buy this $300 aquarium that is really unsuitable for this animal, but of course it looks big while the animal's a baby. You're also suckered into buying all the lights and the this and the that's and the books that these people have that don't make any sense. Oftentimes when I tell people, look, if you're going to learn about these animals, go to a bookstore and find something on that kind of animal. Don't go to the pet store that says, this is how you do it, because I don't think anybody really knows how to keep wild animals in captivity. I think that we just do the best that we can and try and understand their instincts a little bit more every day that you work with them. I mean, it's a constant learning battle, you know.
So what is the frame of mind of a person, as I had an experience of meeting, whose son seemed to enjoy giving the mice to the boa?
I think a lot of people...
What's going on there?
Interesting. I think, like, for me, when I was a little boy, my first experience with a reptile was with a venomous snake back home in England. And I'd caught the snake because it was eating a frog, and that wasn't okay with me. The frog was actually screaming. Little did I know it had already been envenomated and probably took two steps and died. But I couldn't stand it watching it scream, so I helped it. And luckily enough, I never got bitten by it, and I brought it home. And the next time, I was told by my mother at a very early age, about 4 years old, don't catch them, bring them home. They're wild animals. Leave them alone, let alone that this was a dangerous animal. I had no idea. But then, of course, after I'd saved the frog, I thought, neat. This is, you know, I'll just bring it home. Well, I didn't know anything. I was a child. I mean, that's why we call us children, is when we can't look after ourselves. That's why I disagree with children being given animals that live for 20 years that they don't know anything about, or a nocturnal little leopard gecko. But see, some people, they think it's neat. I was told that you leave it alone. So the next time in my grandma's backyard that I saw this adder come through the grass, I thought, okay, I'm not supposed to touch it. I'm not supposed to. And I learned that it was dangerous too, so of course I didn't touch it. And this time I watched as it shot up, and then it went again. And then the third sort of real quick slither, whatever you want to call it, that it made, it had another frog. It bit the frog, and this time I watched it, and the first thing I saw was amazing, was the way that they walk their mouth. It's one side, then the other, and they walk all the way up from the back of the frog all the way to the front. Now, the first time I'd gone to help the frog, and I felt awful. It was screaming, how dare you, snake? I'm going to save this frog, you an awful thing. The next time, I was absolutely blown away, fascinated. I looked at this, I thought, wow, my mom was right. She told me, if you watch, you'll learn something. Boy, did I ever learn something. I had no idea snakes' fangs were, or teeth were used like arms, you know, like climbing apparatus.
Now, earlier you spoke about the legislation that would maybe, if it came into being, would restrict the importation of these exotic animals. But it really rests to target the pet stores. And have you done anything with that?
Yeah, over the years, there's been a lot of work to canvass the Lower Mainland and see what's going on, what's being sold. I mean, soft-shell turtles here in Chinatown is a real tragic story. They're sold as live food. They're chopped up right in front of the customer on the street. I disagree with that. I mean, in 1996, there were permits issued that in order to, I believe, import or export or basically anything to do with these turtles, you had to have this paperwork. Not one of those permits has ever been sold. And that was in 1996. That's 10 years ago.
And it's a restricted item.
Yeah.
Turtles. Everybody loves turtles.
Well, actually, speaking of turtles, I mean, you've got endangered species coming in with import, export. There was a guy in Yarrow, out in Chilliwack here, who's a second-time offender who got caught with endangered species in his glove box.
Mm-hmm. And so I saw this morning that turtles eat fish, frogs, crayfish, snails, and young waterfowl.
Basically, so, I mean, anything that they can find, they can overpower.
Like that for them on a natural basis. And as you said before, no person can exactly duplicate their needs in captivity.
That's
it's
right.
It's a totally faulty premise.
Yes.
Unacceptable.
And we're allowing people,
and
like kids,
people
and off the street.
It if we put the message across. So thank you for being here and letting us know the amount of surplus, the extent of this trade. And I believe Vancouver, after New York, is the second largest port.
Yes.
For exotics.
It's a
right through here.
What we often say, and there's a saying that goes for that, is that Vancouver, BC, most people walk in a refuge are never ready for this. They say, oh, really? I'm amazed at how many people are ignorant to. I mean, we're dealing, ignorance is a very key word in this conversation because that's what we're dealing with. We are dealing with a major ignorance here. Canadians are not bad people. We just have no idea what we're doing. Our ambition is to teach everyone.
But the law in this case is also an ass, isn't it? Because it allows anyone to import any kind of animal into this country.
I mean, you've got Canada, all our native species here, like specifically in British Columbia, you're not allowed to own crows, you're not even allowed to use nets in waterways, yet they sell them in all the dollar stores, there's no signage, you see kids catching eels and frogs with nets in the ponds and rivers. You're not allowed to own any Canadian native species, I believe. Now, maybe I'm wrong, there may be a few here, but you're not allowed to own those pets, basically, and that goes for the majority of Canadian wildlife. Then why on earth would we allow people to have man-eating pythons? I mean, you've got Florida Everglades down in Florida right now is a real problem. They've actually, in the last 2 years, pulled out over 150 Burmese pythons. There was a case where I'm sure some people out there have heard about the alligator that was found inside a dead Burmese python. These are two endangered species that are met in a clash that was created by man. You know, I want people to realize that this problem is a lot bigger than I can ever put into words.
See, and since you don't need to have permits for many of the animals that come in, there's no clear numbers, and some of the estimates that I've read is
no licensing.
We're bringing in about 100,000 reptiles into Canada per year, just based on what we can see, the tip of the iceberg. And anytime you're bringing in animals, you have to sort of guesstimate that half of them are wild caught, and wild-caught animals, you know, they typically 30% don't survive transportation, and in the first year you lose 90%. So 10%
of
whatever
disease
come in
are brought in
die.
What about the airlines? Can they help? Refuse such cargo?
They're involved in shipping. It's illegal. It is illegal cargo, and for animals that are threatened or endangered, if you have the CITES paperwork, you can still bring them in. You need a permit to leave the country, and you'll need a permit to enter the new country. But it's not really that difficult.
I think if the sale was outright banned, I mean, that's what I would like to see, is Canada stand up against this war on wildlife and create a national ban. Maybe even BC first to show all of Canada, hey, you know, we can do it. But until that happens, maybe some licensing. Maybe if you own a man-eating python, people around you should have the right to know about that. They show up in people's backyards. children are killed by Burmese pythons. Even full-grown men. There was a fellow down in Denver that was wrapped up by a small Burmese python. This is as thick as a man's arm and about 9 feet long. And it took six firefighters and two police officers to get the snake off the guy who had already died by asphyxiation. He was crushed to death.
Now, could I just interrupt for a moment? We need to have a station break. And our guests today are Marvin Moot and Paul Springate, I'm sorry, from the Rainforest Reptile Refuge in Surrey, and we'll get back to them very shortly. You are listening to CFRO 102.7 on your FM dial, Vancouver's only cooperative, independent, commercial-free radio station.
Mondays at 7 p.m.
Radical Radio on the People's Station.
CFRO 102.7 FM.
You better not put my son in jail. I'll take this country down.
Hello, we're back on Animal Voices once again with our two guests, Marvin and Paul from the Rainforest Reptile Refuge Rescue Society. I'm sorry, I get that all mixed up. But now, we had a call in during the intermission, and someone wanted the gentleman to speak about feeding animals to animals, so I'm going to start with that.
Okay, well, there's definitely a couple sides to this. Looking at this as a professional, it's hard. Upon fascination is in the beginning. I was 4 years old when I saw a snake eat a frog. I've seen that happen many times now, and the word to use is that people get quite sadistic about it. They think it's neat, and the people that have pythons, hey, let's watch what happens when you throw a rabbit in the cage. We don't do that. We do not feed live animals. We have to raise our own rodents in order to supply our snakes and lizards with food. Mm-hmm. And the last thing we want to do is see these animals raised in this environment and then thrown in Satan's lair. It's not right. You cause all sorts of problems. You're teaching, like our giant retic, if I was to feed that animal live, sadistic or not, we'd be teaching a 24-foot python how to hunt, and that is extremely dangerous for me. I don't particularly want to end up on the inside of her, but it's a very realistic threat. People don't realize that what you have to do is you're supposed to kill the animal before you feed it. If you give a rat to a snake, and the snake might not be hungry, and the rat's scared, it realizes that there's a threat here, and the rat bites the snake. Well, if this snake's like a ball python from West Africa, the bacteria in British Columbia's air is enough to kill it. You know, and you have that sort of, and that's a horror story. We have a lot of animals come in that have been half eaten by their prey. I mean, it's not enjoyable. Public that have never seen it, people get grossed out by it, but I think it is a real problem that you know, the larger animals like crocs, I mean, what are people feeding them? What are they doing? You know, what are people doing in their apartment? You know, one time we had a story with a snapping turtle that we were told by this wonderful person that that he was feeding it kittens, or he tried to feed it kittens. You know, winning absolutely no, you know, favors from us. But this is what we're allowing by allowing people to have these animals.
See, these animals, they've been yanked out of their ecosystem where they're a perfect fit, mm-hmm. with and there's a balance, you know, and we're hauling these animals up here to Canada. And, we're kind of caught in a rather awkward situation where, yeah, we're feeding.
And I myself,
almost animals.
I have to put down our rodents in order to feed the snakes. And I will tell you, it's bothered me for 6 years. It's a necessity, unfortunately. I mean, I love all animals, including rats. They're one of the world's greatest survivors. Yeah. But at the same time, I have a job to do, and I have animals to keep alive in order to educate the public. But no, it's not a good feeling. Some people actually, this is the learning curve. Some people can't kill the rat, so they throw it in live. They're not sadistic, but then they cause the problem by doing that. We actually had a woman who called me a little while ago and insisted that because she had rescued two boas, and if we weren't going to take them, I mean, these are snakes that grow 9-10 feet. We have 3 of them who are 6 feet long. We can't take more. She says, well, if you're not going to take them, then you should be supplying me with the rats. And I thought, well, I don't know about that. You know, I sit here and I'm raising these animals. We raise like hundreds of them at a time, at all times. It's a little bit hard. It goes into the public's expectations of what we do again, right?
Mm-hmm. I'm going to have to interrupt there. We're not going to get the final remarks we would like to have on the show. And Marvin, perhaps you would talk to the audience a little bit about the financing of the shelter.
Well, you know that we like to keep it warm, and we really appreciate donations. But just to give people an idea, our gas bill for January was $694. It costs us about $2,000 a month just to feed all the animals. Lighting, we use a lot of specialized light bulbs. People don't realize it, but reptiles need a full range of light, UVB rays, and so on. So, you know, we can spend up to $100-$150 in light bulbs. There's all those kinds of expenses, and we let people know just so that they think about it in case they're thinking of getting a reptile. But we certainly rely on donations to cover those kinds of costs.
And that's what you rely totally on, donations.
Yeah, and. I do a lot of the deposits, so I see a lot of the checks and so on. And we don't get the big checks from Jimmy Pattison. We get the checks from retired people, you know, small donors who give us $10 or $20 a month, or you know,
maybe the people that are breeding pythons and bearded dragons would like to drop off a donation.
I don't see those.
Yeah, what about the pet stores?
That's right. I mean, they are causing this problem, and there is a job to do. I mean, hey, you know, I work 70 hours a week on these animals. I know there's a heck of a job to do. But the financial side of it is, yes, we need everybody's help out there. Anybody that, I mean, anything. These animals are not going anywhere anytime soon. Spud is 7 years old, will live to 120. He needs all the help he can get. You know, like I said before, is that we can clean the cages, we can keep them clean, we can change light bulbs, but we can't do everything.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you both for being here. Now, would you mind giving us the information on how to get more information if people are interested?
Well, we have a wonderful website, and we invite everyone to visit it. It's reptilerefuge.ca. It's all lowercase. And it's quite extensive, and we get hits from all around the world. In fact, it's funny, we get people calling us from Europe and from the East Coast of the United States, asking us questions, asking us for advice, and not realizing that we're way over here in Vancouver, and they cannot bring their red-eared slider turtle over to us.
Reptilerefuge.com, did you say?
Reptilerefuge.ca. We are located at 1395 176th Street, so just on the way to the Pacific border crossing.
Right down by White Rock, South Surrey.
Our phone number, we are open Saturday and Sunday afternoons for public viewing, and we usually have some tour guides there. Our phone number is 604-538-1711.
Is organic fruit of any use to you?
Absolutely.
Oh, yes.
I got a big bag for them donating today.
Excellent. We take we get people dropping off. They clean out their freezer, and they bring us, whatever. Oh, look at that. That's
oranges
wonderful.
And bananas.
The animals, we have quite a number of the animals that are vegetarian, and tropical fruits go over really well.
And they love bananas.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And,
thank right, you. I feel good.
Oh, that's great. I'm going to have to cut in now. I'm sorry, but this is the absolute end because we do have to get another interview on here. But thank you so much, both to...
And if anybody out there wants to buy a reptile, do your research.
Yeah, and thank you so much for having us.
You're welcome,
thank
and
you.
We would like to have you back.
Soon.
You've been listening to an interview with Marvin Moot, president of the Rainforest Reptile Refuge Society, and Paul Springgate, I wish I could get that right, and he's the curator of the rescue shelter. So now we're going to go on to our second part of our show, which is an interview with Patricia Oswald of the Canadian Canadians
Canadian
for
the
Ethical Treatment of Food Animals, CETFA. Now, we have to get that on right away, please, Alan. Responsible for 95% of all animal suffering. Practices that are legally permitted in the breeding, raising, and slaughtering of food animals are rife with animal abuse. In the factory farm industry, cows, horses, pigs, chickens, sheep, and many other creatures are given no more consideration than a box of soap on an assembly line. Each is simply a unit of production, the sole purpose of which is to produce profit. Fortunately, there are groups and individuals who are committed to relieving the suffering of such animals. One of these groups is Canadians for the Ethical Treatment of Food Animals. Today we are pleased to have the president of that group to shed some light on factory farming in Canada. Welcome to Animal Voices, Patricia.
Thank you, Marge.
Will you tell us something about your organization?
Canadians for Ethical Treatment of Food Animals, CETFA for short, is a registered non-profit society whose purpose is to promote the humane treatment of animals raised for food. We exist to work towards the compassionate treatment of food animals so that their lives may be free from pain and fear, followed by a humane death.
How long has your group been working?
Tina Harrison founded our group 11 years ago when Tina met with four others to discuss the massive abuse of animals under intensive factory farming conditions. They visited barns and slaughterhouses and witnessed animal transport situations. They were deeply disturbed by what they saw.
How did they feel the situation could be changed?
Well, educating the public became very important. Few people seem aware of the cruelty inflicted on conscious animals with their capacity to feel and fear before they arrive as food on our dinner plates. We strive to inform people about the appalling suffering which is hidden from view in the production of cheap food.
Who are the members of CETFA?
We have members from all across Canada, people who recognize the problems we face and want to do something about it. Consumers, producers, and many of the farmers who see firsthand the dehumanizing effect of factory farming.
Could you tell us something about your goals?
The goals we're working toward at the moment are to have present laws against cruelty to livestock far more stringently enforced. We want much stronger legislation against animal cruelty, which must apply to animals raised for food. Unfortunately, the BC Prevention of Cruelty to Animals Act fails in this respect, and voluntary guidelines are simply not effective. Inspections of slaughterhouses and livestock transport vehicles need to be drastically increased. We want to see charges laid and penalties imposed whenever deliberate cruelty or cruelty through negligence is discovered. We support organic, cruelty-free farming. We feel that those farmers who do meet humane standards of animal husbandry should be able to have their products clearly identified at the retail level. labeling humanely raised food as such would allow consumers to make informed choices. We urge the government to curb the routine use of antibiotics and hormones in food animals, and we're opposed to the use of genetically altered crops in food animal fodder.
Patricia, you say that BC Prevention of Cruelty to Animals Act fails to protect animals raised for food. Can you explain that?
Well, the BC Prevention of Cruelty to Animals Act fails to protect animals raised for food because it specifically excludes animals in distress, quote, if the distress results from an activity that is carried on in accordance with reasonable and generally accepted practices of animal management. Procedures which are somehow considered reasonable and generally accepted and are therefore permitted under this designation include the use of electric prods, debeaking of baby chicks without pain relief, castration without anesthetic, branding and tail docking without protection from pain, hot iron dehorning of young calves. This involves the application of searing heat for a full 30 seconds on each of the calf's horn buds, first on one side of its head and then repeated a second time, again for a full 30 seconds, on the other, all this without anesthetic. There are many more examples.
It's hard to believe that anything so blatantly cruel as chopping off the beak of a chick is an accepted practice of animal management. The cruelty of all these practices is totally overwhelming. Does your group advocate an end to eating meat products?
That's not our mandate. We want to support farmers who use humane methods, and we're strongly in favor of organic farming, which allows animals to lead more normal lives in keeping with their needs, as well as being more healthy for the consumer and the environment. It's the suffering imposed on animals used in factory farming which concerns us. We are against practices throughout the industry which are deemed reasonable and acceptable under the Act, but which cause fear, pain, and distress.
What do you mean by factory farming?
Factory farms are large operations where animals are viewed as units of production, like raw materials in a factory. Costs are cut in order to produce cheap food and augment the profits of shareholders in large corporations.
The fact that food animals are sensitive, intelligent creatures is entirely disregarded. How do you feel about agribusiness as it relates to animal husbandry?
Agribusiness means agriculture conducted on strictly commercial principles. The kind of care, knowledge, and understanding that could be expected from the owner of a small family farm is not deemed to have commercial value. Horrific practices are excused in the name of profitability.
Tell me more about what you object to in factory farming.
Costs are cut without regard for what an animal experiences as a consequence. This includes isolation, immobilization, deprivation of fresh air, sunlight, and the opportunity to exercise or socialize, or they may be confined in overcrowded space. For example, laying hens remain cramped in cages with wire floors without room to exercise or spread their wings and groom themselves for their entire lives. Pecking is natural to poultry, but in a cage the victim can't get away. The solution is to cut off their extremely sensitive beaks. Without any kind of natural life, immobilization results in weakened, easily broken bones and damaged wings, adding to the injuries they suffer when they're finally loaded into travel crates to meet the inhumane fate of spent hens. Veal crates are still allowed in Canada. Sows are confined in gestation stalls and farrowing crates.
Do you feel that these stresses which are endured have any impact on the quality of food produced for our tables?
Well, obviously stress produces a chemical reaction in all of us and surely affects the quality of meat. Another very tangible impact of stress on food animals is the need for medication to maintain their health. Pharmaceutical companies benefit when antibiotics are widely used. When they are needed to counterbalance the reduced efficiency of immune systems undermined by stress, we, the consumers, are taking the end result of this into our own bodies.
Do family farmers have a role to play in the humane food production?
Of course they do. There are many farmers who operate in an ethical manner. Some concentrate on humanely raised produce for consumers willing to pay a bit more to know that the animals they eat have had better lives. SETFA fully supports the family farmer. However, huge factory farms are generally not owned by private farmers. They're usually owned by corporations, often multinational ones. Already in Manitoba, there is growing concern about foreign agribusiness wanting to set up enormous factory barns for the production of pigs.
Yes, I've heard many Manitoba residents are voicing their objections. What would you like to see happen?
We'd like the government to give encouragement to family farmers rather than to multinational corporations. We'd like to see farmers who treat their animals humanely given recognition and support. And this is important. We ask consumers to take responsibility for not buying into cruelty, to choose free-range chickens, free-range eggs, and organically produced meat and dairy products whenever this is possible, and to request them in the stores when they're not available.
Good idea. I notice more grocery stores are stocking organic food, free-range eggs, and milk that comes from organically fed cows, which is encouraging. In closing, are there any other issues that you would like to see addressed?
The transport of live animals is another area where there is acute suffering. According to figures provided by the Canadian Food Inspection Agency, in 1999, of the 600 million food animals slaughtered annually, that year, nearly 3.5 million of them arrived at federally inspected slaughterhouses either found dead or not acceptable for slaughter. Each one of these individual animals had experienced acute, often prolonged suffering. So did the many animals who, though injured, made it to the killing floor, and so who don't appear in the data provided by the agency. Remember, this number does not include animals arriving at uninspected slaughterhouses.
When you say found dead, what does this include?
Found dead animals are those found to be dead at the time of delivery to the abattoir, or those which have died in the holding pens prior to slaughter. Another term, downers, refers to those animals which are still alive but too sick or seriously injured to be able to move, usually due to broken legs, hips, or backs. There are no economic consequences for cruelty involved when these live animals are moved by inhumane methods. When an animal arrives at the slaughterhouse alive, no matter how badly injured it may be, if it can be got to the killing floor for slaughter, the supplier will be paid for it. Cases of injured animals being euthanized are very rare.
What are some of the causes of death and injury in transport?
Dying from heat in summer, freezing to death in winter, fast driving causing vehicles to lurch, injuries or suffocation when one animal lies or falls on a weaker one, being forced to jump when appropriate ramps are not available, especially when animals are weakened by long periods without food or water in transit.
Arrival at slaughterhouses must always be traumatic.
Yes. Time-saving practices inflict a brutal death. Vast numbers are not adequately stunned before the killing process. Secrecy is a very big problem. Slaughterhouses are closed to the public. Full disclosure of slaughterhouse infractions are difficult for the layperson to document, for the industry is careful not to expose itself with respect to slaughterhouse practices.
What is the best way to bring an end to the cruelty inflicted on food animals?
Public influence is the only thing that can really bring about change. Change in attitudes towards animals raised for food is desperately needed.
And how can that be brought about?
We believe that by continuing to educate the public about cruelty in all the aspects of food animal production, in the raising of the animals, in their transport, and in their slaughter, the general public will come to understand the need to bring their influence to bear both on the government and at the retail level.
And what ways can our listeners help?
Well, since we know that public pressure brings about change, then every little individual effort helps and counts for something. During the coming election, we hope you'll be sure to attend all candidates' meetings in your areas and ask the candidates what position they take on animal cruelty laws. Do they agree with the need to include food animals in this legislation so that they get protection which does not exist right now? Could you write to your MPs and MLAs with requests for much stronger legislation against cruelty to animals and to make sure that livestock are included in that legislation? And please communicate to the media about the concerns you may have and write to your newspapers letters to the editor telling them how you feel about the issues we have mentioned. Remember to vote with your wallet at the retail level by only buying humanely produced food and ask for food labelling to help you. Do let SETFA know of any instances of food animal abuse if you ever become aware of them. It would help if you could document any instances you may witness.
Thank you for that. Now, is it possible for the listeners to contact SETFA?
Oh, yes. We would very much like to hear from listeners. Our address is Canadians for Ethical Treatment of Food Animals, Box 18024, 2225 West 41st Avenue, Vancouver, BC, V6M4L3. We eagerly welcome new members, and if any listeners would like to join, please either write us for a membership application or telephone Dorothy in Vancouver, who will be looking forward to hearing from you at area code 604-322-0448. We also hope you'll visit our website at www.cetfa.com to learn more about us.
Now, in case you didn't get those addresses and telephone number, please get yourself a pencil and they will be repeated at the end of the show. Thank you very much. Now, Patricia, tell me, do you have a newsletter?
Oh, yes. Members receive our newsletters, and we would love to hear from any listeners who feel they have time or ideas to contribute to our efforts, or who feel that they can support us in any way.
Thank you, Patricia, for being with us this afternoon. You've provided valuable information about your organization and the appalling treatment of food animals. Thanks for listening to Animal Voices. Remember, there will be a replay of this broadcast 4 to 5 next Monday. Bye-bye.